Hi, my name is Bruce Perham. Welcome to my podcast series, Trauma from the Frontline. In this series, we'll be interviewing a wide range of people that work in the frontline industries who will be sharing their professional and personal thoughts and ideas about working in the field and some of the challenges that they all confront. Hi there, this is Bruce Perham from Trauma from the Frontline. Today we're going to do something a little bit differently, and I've actually got a good friend of mine, Felicity Childs, who is going to interview me about my narrative therapy training and a bit about Michael White and his narrative therapy. Welcome, Felicity. I can relax today and not have to think of the questions and delegate that to you. So welcome.
Thank you very much, Bruce. It's great to be here. And we've known each other for quite some time and worked together as colleagues and become coffee mates as well. So it's really fantastic, I think, that you've ventured on this journey with the podcast and speaking to so many different people. And I know that the value of lived experience is just so important to you. Can you shed a bit of light as to how this journey began with this interest in narrative therapy and lived experience?
I'd love to. And often I say to people, if you get me talking about narrative therapy, you'll have to tell me to shut up, or their eyes glaze over and I can see that, okay, I've gone on too long. So I'll try and be good. Many years ago, I was working at the MS Society, Multiple Sclerosis, and I went out to do a home visit to a family where the mother had MS, and there were issues between the father and the daughter. So it was sort of a bit of a family session to talk to them, or you know, discuss with them the issues that were going on. And at some point during the interview, I asked the 14-year-old daughter what type of relationship did she want to have with her father in 5 years' time. And she looked at me, she said, what the fuck has that got to do with anything? And when I was driving back to the office, I thought, what the fuck did that have to do with anything? I had no idea why I asked the question. And I thought, well, maybe I was trying to get her to look at whether she wants to have a good relationship with her father in the future. But I really had no idea. And I certainly had no idea of what the next question was going to be. So that was the point that I thought, I really need to upskill here. I need to learn a lot more about family therapy, about counselling, about, that was the moment I thought, I've just had no idea. And so what came out of that was I decided to do a family therapy course, and that's back in 1989 now, so it's a long time ago. And I was looking for a way of working with the families I was working with. It wasn't any more than that. I wasn't thinking of becoming a family therapist. I just wanted to learn more about I was looking for a way of working with families that was better than what I was doing. And it was, I think, later in the first year of the course, as a part of the course, we did a 2-day training out in Eltham with Michael White, who I'd never heard of Michael before, and I'd never heard of narrative therapy before. And, as I sat there in the 2 days and I listened to Michael talk about narrative therapy and what it was, and it's the importance of connecting with people, the importance of hearing their story, I just sat there and I just thought, wow, this is sort of what I've been looking for in a way, that of something that was not unbelievably complex to me, and something that I could relate to and something that I could do. I've never forgotten at the time, I wrote to Michael after that and I said, look, I really appreciated the 2 days, and it was just terrific to come across a way of working that is just so simple.
I just listening to all of this, it sort of strikes me that there are two very strong memories there of that young girl's response, how that impacted you and sort of drove you to find a different way. And then, a 2 days of, I suppose, total enlightenment about a different approach. So after those 2 days, did you ever go back and rethink how you might have responded to that young girl who was really struggling, obviously?
Yeah. Look, it's interesting. I've told that story a couple of times, but I hadn't. Yeah, so yeah, it's a really good question, and you know, now I would be far more interested to hear her story, and it's actually a critical part of narrative. Is that, you know, as therapists, you make judgments or you make assumptions based on your own experience, and you don't actually listen to what the person's saying or connecting to their own experience or their view of their own experience. So I'd be pretty certain in that situation. Again, I'd be far more interested to hear what this young lady was feeling and seeing about her life than making any type of judgment, therapeutic judgment, about what might be in her best interest. So that's what I'd hope that I would do. So that opened my eyes, and I then decided to Michael. Now, I should actually say Michael White passed away 14 years ago, 16 years ago now, in 2008. So we lost him. So, you know, I have my memories, but Michael's no longer with us, but he's with me in lots of ways. So then I decided to go and do a week intensive, which back in those days, it was in Adelaide. Michael was practiced in Adelaide, and there was about 11 of us, and we were there for the week, and pretty much had Michael every day. And sort of backtracking a little, in Code Blue, in the first chapter, I shared my own experience of losing my twin sister and the impact that had on our family at the time and had on me. And then, you know, I shared in the chapter, because it connects with trauma, around the breakdown, or whatever you want to call it, that I had in my late 20s, where I became severely depressed and I spent 2 years in therapy. Now, I always had felt ashamed about that. I'd always felt that, you know, it was sort of weakness. I never told anybody. I tried to keep it from people. So I would never have told an employer. I would never have told a colleague. I would never have told anybody, because, you know, you just have this sense of that, you know, having gone through that was somehow a sense of shame. So anyway, now if I wind the clock forward again. And so going to Dulwich, which is where Michael practiced for that week, and at the start of the week he said, well, who'd like to be interviewed by him? And, you know, oh my God, you know, I'm an introverted, shy person. There's no way I'm going to have, you know, this man who was a brilliant therapist interview me. So I didn't put my hand up. But about five of the participants did. And in the course of the week, Michael interviewed them. And he interviewed them about their work. And it was just to sit there and to, you know, watch him interview the fellow students and to hear the sorts of questions that he asked. And as the week evolved, he really introduced the idea of, because everyone, you know, everyone he interviewed would end up with their terrible stories of, you know, of what had happened to them as people, or as children, the complexity of what they'd been through psychologically. There was a fellow there who'd been sexually abused by his older brother and was working with youth. Now, in our judgment thinking, you know, I was imagining, oh, is that really appropriate? Is that, you know, ooh, you know? But Michael's view in the way he interviewed and was very much about, well, maybe these lived experiences contribute to the therapist that you are, you know, and he would call that insider knowledge. You know, maybe you have knowledge of things that other people don't, and maybe that informs your work. And so what he did was he portrayed that as not a negative, but as potentially as a positive, of that these experiences are part of your lived experience, and maybe that they have more going for them than what you think they have. So for me, that was quite explosive, you know, to have a concept of, I didn't need to be ashamed of what I went through, and you know, I look back now and I think, you know, how was I not going to go through that at some point in my life? But to then think, well, maybe that informs my work. So it's hard to put words to that, but it was just like this major shift of well, maybe it's useful to me. I don't need to hide from it. I don't need to feel it's a negative. And so from that moment on, really, I started to – I can remember sitting on the bus coming back. I used to catch the night bus there to do the course. Now, I can remember thinking, wow, there's just so much happened in that week. I just can't process it. I just can't get my head around it. And it was probably 2 or 3 years before I could really start to think, okay, that's opened up a lot of doors that weren't open. And that I went back several times, and in 1999, 2000, I did the graduate diploma there.
I was just thinking, I had that expression in my mind that it did open doors for you. And actually, it sounds like Michael was terrific at giving people permission and, you know, the value he was able to expound to people about what you've just said and how that information can be seen quite differently. And so what an amazing impact he had.
And Michael is an amazing man, and he just to talk a bit about narrative, he used to tell a wonderful story. He was working at the Adelaide Children's Hospital, and he went away on holidays, and he came back, and the medical director had taken his family therapy chairs. And so he put a complaint into the board about that he wanted his family therapy chairs back. And the medical director was really pissed off because the board made him give his family therapy chairs back to Michael. So in the context, this is a social worker working at the hospital, and he demands his family therapy chairs back. And that was Michael, you know. And anyway, but he said from then on, all the referrals he got were of soiling kids. What do they say, onchoparesis or whatever the name is for it. So he decided to roll his sleeves up and get in and try and understand what was happening in these families where they had children that were soiling. And some of his early work was brilliant. All of his work is brilliant, but some of that was around, or where I think originated the idea of, he formed the view that that the parents were focusing on the child as the problem. And so in his early therapy, he would externalise the soiling. And the famous example of it, you know, he would have he'd get the child to name it. So he'd be saying, well, you know, what happens? I've never forgot this one interview. We used to watch his interviews with this child. And so this, I don't know, 6 or 7 year old child sitting there, and I think mum might have been there as well. And Michael says, so tell me what's happening. And this boy says, oh, you know, I poo my pants. And Michael says, what happens then? And he says, oh, the poo all runs down my leg, and it gets into my socks, and all the kids call me stinky. And you know, and Michael, which is core narrative, asks him, well, is this a good thing or a bad thing? And the little boy says, oh, it's a bad thing. I hate it. Now, what Michael would say in that is, well, that's the child taking a stance on the problem. And we need children to take a stance on the problem. Mum already has a stance on the problem. Dad already has a stance on the problem. But I need to hear what the child's stance on the problem is. And then once he heard that it's a bad thing, well, then his questions are more and then he went into, well, can you think of a name? Can you call it something? And this little boy goes, sneaky poo, because it sneaks up on me, you know. It happens and I can't control it. And so the rest of therapy was about sneaky poo. And what Michael did and what he wrote about it was, he externalised the problem. So his view is, if you externalise the problem and you unite the mother and father with the child against the problem, that you'll have a better therapeutic outcome. So, you know, that's very much in his early work, but it set the tone of seeing the problem as the problem, which I don't know whether he else named that. I think Michael's one of the earliest ones to name the problem as the problem. And but the hearing of the person's description, no matter how old they were, he always wanted to hear.
So would you say his therapy and the way he worked with all his clients, including young children, was fairly unique at that time?
I would say that absolutely. Trailblazer. I think there's a lot. You know, I go to different sorts of training and I'll hear people say things and I'll go, that's narrative. You know, that's, you know, because back in that day, you know, it was very confronting for traditional therapies in that one, Michael was totally against diagnosing. He saw... you know, or he wrote a lot and talked a lot about the expert, or when the expert gives you a diagnosis that confirms the problem. So if you've got mental health issues and you are diagnosed with a variety of conditions, that confirms the problem. Oh, well, this top psychiatrist has said that I've got this problem, so I've got this problem.
So does that imply a sense of helplessness in some ways for the client?
I think Michael feels it was a backward step, whereas he would always be interested in the person's view of their life. And look, and as I, you know, I mentioned before, I used, originally saw it as simple. It's far from simple. It's a highly, highly complex way of working. And but Michael felt that the people were very influenced by the culture of Western, what he used to call Western society, and that people were marginalised. So the, you know, criminals. People that were gay, you know, are marginalised by the way society views them. Now, we really don't need to argue that point. I think we've got more awareness of the marginalisation. But I never really deeply got an understanding of it, but Michael was very much about culture and the impact that has on the individual and the Western view of I rather than community. He was very community-oriented in, you know, people need to support people and that, you know, in lots of ways, you know, a lot of people have experiences that are very marginalising.
That's right. And I suppose, and the ability to feel that you can share your experience gives that person, would you say, some sense of ownership and power.
Yeah.
And that can sort of filter through the community that they're with.
And a lot of what Michael's interviewing was, or the narrative, was that he always had a belief that we have a dominant story of ourselves. And that'll be one that's prescribed, you know, generally you're not good at something, or you're this or you're that, or, you know, or that it's, you know, you need surgery to correct your sexual, you know, all these types of values and, you know, there's something wrong with you, or, you know, to be gay, there's something wrong, you know, with you. He felt everyone had an alternative story to their dominant story. I don't know if you gobbledygook on it, but and so that what the therapy was doing was trying to connect people with those alternative stories. And look, I can give a lighthearted example that he shared when he was seeing this woman, and she said, "Oh, my husband's really angry with me. You know, I crashed the car into the letterbox, and it's all damaged." And Michael was a bit, what would you say? I don't know, a bit of, you know, he leaned back in his chair and he said, "That sounds like an act of resistance to me." And, you know, this woman laughs. So that the going back can, you know, you can go back, but you can revisit and in, say, more serious, like sexual trauma. Michael did a lot of work with people that had been sexually abused. And, you know, people, you know, would say, "Well, I lay there and I didn't resist." But in the therapy, that would bring out that, but that was resistance, you know, whatever, you know, it was. So it's the going back, even though you can't change what's happened, but you can work with your view of what you did.
That's right. And interpretations can, you know, give rise to that sense of, I guess, flexibility that we can have with how we review something or maybe, you know, just looking to the future as to how we might do this, that we don't see ourselves as we've always been told this is who you are. And
one of the key things I learned from that is that, you know, Michael would always, you know, you need to not have a view. You cannot have a thought about what this person should or shouldn't do, or about what they did do, or you cannot have a thought as a therapist. It is 100% inquiry into their lived experience. Now, when you actually think about that, that's not easy. It takes a long time to do it because we're all taught, you know, oh, this is a dysfunctional, or the mum's dysfunctional, or, you know, if you sit in a case meeting, it's all about dysfunction, about, well, this person's not coping, or that person, you know, minute that's got a judgment. Michael would never have any of that in terms of no judgment, no thoughts. Your thoughts are irrelevant. The only thoughts you should have about what are the therapeutic questions you're going to ask. And he used to say, you never introduce a word. And look, it has stuck with me forever. So that when you're interviewing somebody, you never say, oh, that must have been difficult for you, because you've introduced the word difficult. And as he would say, that totally sidetracks the conversation. So that if you ask somebody, what was that experience like for you? And they say, well, it was just like a dark cloud hanging over me. He would then ask a question about the dark cloud. What's that like to have a dark cloud hanging over you? And when you watched him work, he never introduced an idea or a word. He would sometimes introduce a metaphor. I can give an example of a session that we were observing. It was a young woman with anorexia and her mother. And this young woman talked about that she had gone for a walk along the beach in her bikini, and that was against the voice of anorexia, because anorexia didn't want her to do that. And Michael, as he leaned back, and he said, that sounds like a walk against anorexia. So that this woman was resisting what anorexia was wanting her to do. And she just lit up and she just said, that's exactly what it was. And a little bit later in the interview, he said, I notice that you have a Band-Aid on your finger. And she said, Yes, I do. He said, what happened? He said, I cut my finger. He said, well, did anorexia let you put a Band-Aid on it? Because that's an act of self-care to me. And she said, oh, no, I had to do it without anorexia knowing. That attention to detail, but the asking of a question and waiting for the response, and then having your response dictated to by the response.
Which is quite a discipline, isn't it, in a way, to hold yourself back. I think, you know, generally we're very quick to make an assertion or feel we have to respond really quickly. And it reminds me of a friend who recalled she has a child with autism, and somebody who's a social worker who just met her, and they became quite friendly briefly. And this happened quite a long time ago, and it really stuck with her. And she shared with me how this person said to her, oh, it must be really hard for you having a child with autism. And it very much offended her. Yes. And she said, I couldn't say it at the time, but I thought later I really wanted to say, actually, it's not. No. She's my child. And that sort of imposition, and this is a person who works in social work and would probably have no idea of the impact, and therefore it actually shifted that friendship was really no longer.
It's a perfect example of what that does. And if you ask, what's it like to have an autistic child? She can say, well, it's my child. It's no different to any other child. I love my autistic child. And then you can ask questions of that. But the minute you do, it's just, and yeah, there's just be 50 million examples. The minute you introduce a descriptive word, that's your word. So that's, that social worker would find that it would be hard to have an autistic child. Nothing to, you know, so it's a really, really good example. And because what that means then is people get silenced by these responses. And so then people don't talk because no one's really listening.
And then they kind of bury that, which this person I know did, and became actually quite resentful and has never really voiced that because now it's just too hard. And that's sort of a kind of, I shouldn't really say minor, it did have an impact, but when we look at, say, when we've, you know, met people with a lot of distress that has accumulated over the years, I guess, because of people saying various things or therapists labelling, telling you what to do, not that inquiry that just allows somebody to flourish a little bit more, I guess.
It's the real, many years ago, my mother said to me that at the time that we lost Leanne, who was 2.5, that the minister said to her, we lost a stillborn baby. At least you had your daughter for 2.5 years. Now, my mother never, that was the last day she went to church because of that comment, you know, that one comment from a minister to compare grief, you know. And so those comments do enormous damage. And but that's sort of what I learned, you know, the importance of actually listening to what the person says without your response being influenced by what you think, but being influenced by what you're hearing. There was just some core things in that I learnt that became very much a part of everything I do. I wanted to talk about narrative is that, you know, this next series next year or this year, edit that out, man. This series this year is going to focus on, you know, people telling their story. And, you know, when I look back in terms of writing Code Blue, it's very much about, you know, listening to what people said. You know, this is how people are describing their lives. You know, this is how they're describing the issues that they have. And we need to listen to it.
And when you interviewed those people, Bruce, did you get a sense that this was sort of like a valve release for them, that this hadn't really happened in that kind of manner before?
Look, it certainly was. And most of Code Blue is written out of group training they did, but it was not overhead training, it was discussion training. So, you know, I'd sit with officers and say, tell us about your work, you know, is it stressful? And it was extraordinary, really, how you know, much the officers took the opportunity to share their experiences. Now, on the one hand, you know, you've got the, you know, bottle it up, you know, don't let anybody know that you're suffering, just get back to work the next day, get back on the horse. Absolutely alive and well in there's more awareness around it now. But, you know, funnily enough, when, you know, you'd put 12, 15 officers together and go, how are you tracking? They all opened up. Like, they all talked about their trauma. They all talked about the visions of what they see. So it wasn't, we all just get up and come to work and, you know, none of it, you know, affects us. You know, some officers would say, yeah, they've just learned to live with it. And, you know, but the vast majority would share trauma experiences, would talk about how they felt crushed by the system, all sorts of things, very openly.
And did that narrative therapy background, did that kind of help with that?
Totally.
Almost like a tsunami of, that's what it sounds like to me, of, spilling out what's been happening.
And I guess, you know, one of the things, several things I learned from Michael, but one of them was, you know, very much that you are not responsible for people's lives. You know, you are there to go on a journey with them, but you're not responsible for the outcome in terms of you're helping them to, you know, resurrect or reclaim or to reconnect with, as he would say, parts of themselves that have been lost by other things. So like the example of the act of resistance, that's very different to being a pathetic, stupid bitch. Well, no, there was more to it than you being a pathetic, stupid bitch. There's a whole nother story to that of resistance, of times that you shielded the children from the violence, or you know, a whole lot of other stories about what people do in those sort of situations. Well, Michael's view is they get lost and people get disconnected from them, so that part of the therapy is reconnecting them with... So in those group situations, you know, in Code Blue, you're actually providing people with an opportunity to share what they think without me judging it, without, I have no agenda in that. Sometimes it would, you know, as it often does, would drift into, feeling let down by management or let down by leadership or bitter about that. Well, that's what the group tell me, you know. I'm not there to go, oh, that can't be true, you know. That's what I'm hearing, you know. So it was very helpful for me because I didn't feel I had to fix it.
That I guess a qualifier, isn't it, about just where you sit within that person's emotional world, and I guess trying in some ways to improve their ability to live with it, improve, you know, how they're going to view, give meaning to it, and
give voice to it, to hear their own thoughts. You know, wow, I can't believe I said that. A little bit of a different example was when I was at MS Society and I did a video interview. I took a cameraman out there. And very, very tense situation, very volatile situation. And in the interview, the carer, so it was the wife with MS, the carer really lost it in expressing his grief of the destruction of his life, of how he felt like killing himself. He really shared a lot about the despair he was feeling. And obviously when we finished filming, you know, doing the filming, I'm thinking, my God, have I opened up a hornet's nest here? But then, you know, I just stay true to what I know in terms of, no, I can sit with this, you know, I can deal with this, I can respond to this. I don't need to, you know, I just need to sit with it, sit with him. And we did that after it. When I went back and showed him the tape, you know, he sat there and he looked at it and he said, I can't believe how well I spoke. I can't believe how I articulated the confusion in my head. And we talked about that. I said, well, you expressed it magnificently when we did the interview. So he said, I really feel the better for it.
It was an opportunity he hadn't had before.
Yeah. And then to see how well he presented it and how well he articulated it. And I said to him, anyone can listen to that and they'll know exactly what you're going through because you expressed it so well. So he was quite chuffed. You know, he was sort of like
It's a bit of a badge of feeling proud he could do that.
He thought it was terrible. He probably thought that, you know, he was pathetic, that he'd come across. In actual fact, it gave him a whole different view of and I think when we were going, he said, if everyone would come and talk to a carers group, I'd be happy to do it. You know, like it just really, and it just reflected a different story for him. And
can we touch back just with when you're talking about the groups that you have been running in the various prisons? Just wondered, you know, with the impact of, say, one person opening up with others, how they might have responded, or, you know, that sort of sense of, wow, you know, now Joe's saying something or other. How did that sort of work within the groups, did you find?
Look, generally really well. And there would always be a couple of officers that were just disengaged and sit there with the arms crossed looking out the window. They just did not engage. But generally everybody did and would add to what people were saying, which, you know, is, I go home and do that too. I did one session that was really quite moving in terms of someone tabled that, you know, they went home one day and the wife said, you're different, you're angry, you're withdrawn, you drink too much. you're nowhere near the man I married. And, you know, and he shared with the group. He said, you know, I bounced back. I said, that's ridiculous. You know, what are you talking about? But to his credit, he started to think about it, and he started to think, I am. I'm very different to the person that I used to be. Everyone in that group tuned into that. They all tuned into that. And one woman said, well, I've had three husbands. That shows you how fucked I am. You know, it's just everybody tuned into that. And then you realize how no one ever has a chance to talk about themselves or to talk about what they think or to share that the work is starting to get on top of them. And, you know, if there's a critical incident, okay, a counsellor comes out and, you know, sort of focus on the incident. But there's really very little focus on the day-to-day of how people are actually tracking, and we just neglect their experience, you know. We neglect, you know, I haven't had really anybody in the workplace say much to me about, you know, my manager asked me how I was going or am I on my career path or, you know, what do I feel about coming into work? You know, we don't ask those questions anymore. And so you sort of sadly find, well, no one ever has much of a chance to talk about their struggles or their mental health or because we don't have those conversations anymore.
Right? And it sounds like that those group sessions that you did do in the prisons, you know, given the culture that we know and how, you know, often it's like we have to be very strong and not show any weakness was a wonderful opportunity. I'm just wondering, you know, do the prison management view it as being very valuable, would you say, or something
too? I'd have to say at this point dubious. And you know, where do I come from? You know, I come from a counsellor that sits with people that are highly distressed, quite rightly highly distressed. And, you know, the more that even that I've done these interviews and the more you understand how could they not be distressed by what they're working with and the pressures that they're under and the complexities of what they're under. But when you see the pain, you know, when you see what this work does to people, and then, you know, one of the things I feel really strongly, we're all silenced. No one can say anything. No one working within a system can criticise it anymore. As though their social media is monitored, everything's monitored, the confidentiality agreements. You know, so anybody really working in these industries can say nothing, or they'll be labelled a whistleblower. Or we don't have scenarios where people can be open about what they think. We just don't. People just don't get the opportunity to really talk about it. Or if they do, it won't be dealt with in the right way, or they'll be silenced. Or just to share a story about Michael, it was one afternoon, a lovely afternoon at Dulwich, and Michael said, is anyone interested to know why I'm so influenced by Foucault? Now, Foucault was a French philosopher back in the 19th century, I think, and Michael was very influenced by his work, and he did all sorts of different things. Now, I'm not intellectual enough to read Foucault, but so we sort of would love to talk about your connection with Foucault. So Michael raced upstairs, got this documentary that had been done on Foucault, and talked about that narrative assumes nothing and questions everything. And he said that's what Foucault did. And I think Foucault got himself admitted into a prison system or a psych ward or something, and then observed everything that was happening within the system. I forget what he wrote, but he wrote an article on his experiences within the system. And, you know, Michael said, you know, we don't march up and down the street with placards, you know, going, you know, narrative is this, narrative is that. He said narrative is assume nothing and question everything. And so that's what Michael did in his work. And he talked about, and it's very relevant, taken for granted practices, things we just take for granted and accept without question. He said, well, narrative will question that.
Which I guess flies in the face of organisations that you've described who actually prefer it's all got to be quiet and silent. It's actually the antithesis, isn't it, of what he's... grown in his narrative therapy.
You know, and and we need to have a voice about our lived experience. And, you know, Michael would always say, you know, the person is the expert on their life. No one else is the expert on their life. The person is the expert on their life. And any dialogue should be with that acceptance that, well, you know your life better than what I do. I'm just here to help you unlock it a little bit. So, you know, partly what has driven the book and certainly drives the podcast is we have to be more open about, you know, as workers, I often call us all worker bees, you know, we have to be more open about, well, this isn't right, you know, this isn't how it should be. And we need this and we need that and we need our employer to have a better understanding of how trauma impacts on us. So we need all that. We need to hear our voice. And the number of times, and in a way, I love anybody to come on and talk to me about how the system hears the voices, because everybody I talk to doesn't feel they're heard. So, and, you know, I always challenge people, go and have a read of the Senate inquiry in 2018 into the mental health of first responders. It's the same story over and over and over and over again. Organisations are disconnected from their workforces. So when people come to me and say Code Blue is anti-management, no, it's pro-voices. Not anti-anything. As Michael would say, it's pro-voices. It's pro-hearing what this is what your people think. Well, this is what they said. So I can't write Code Blue to be pro-management. I ought to write it for what it is. This is what they said. So let's deal with what they said.
So sort of being more authentic to actually the people that are, well, I guess in some ways. That, and how would you say that because they are sort of, I suppose, monitored so much, which is a little bit like what they're doing with prisoners, and now they're kind of, in a sense, in a cell in their own way. What's that like for you to know that that's affecting so many of those employees?
It's extremely frustrating because you just want these experiences to be given credibility, not questioned. You know, I still think, I've never really worked in the military, but I still remember how long it took for our government to recognise that Agent Orange was cancerous, was carcinogenic. For all those troops that were in Vietnam, they got sprayed with Agent Orange, and then the years they had to fight to get recognition of that. That shouldn't happen. That just should not happen. You know, there shouldn't be resistance. There should be, we need to understand it. We need to understand what military experience has done to these young men and women that were sent there. And you know, it's the same challenge with frontline work. It's the same challenge now. We need to understand it. We need to understand how this work impacts on people. The only way you can do that is to hear it. Anyway, that's where
I sit
with it.
It's it just reminds me of Freud, who used to talk about, you know, companies and organisations, even in his day, he talked about, you know, they'll espouse all these wonderful values, but when there's some stress in the system, the basic values of their survival creep up. That's the one that really counts. And I guess that's what I'm hearing from you, that resistance, stubbornness, close it down, it's not to be spoken about, still predominates.
And look, you know, and I think that there's a almost a we don't need to hear the story to solve the problem. We'll just work out what we need to do in the health and wellbeing space, and we'll implement it, and that will be problem solved. And if you don't listen to the story, if you don't understand what people are saying or how they describe their workplace or how they describe the impact it's having on them, you can't solve it.
Your experience, I guess, is telling the audience that those people aren't really being helped in the most appropriate way.
You know, not globally. There'll be times, you know, people say to me, my manager was great or my senior was great or the response to the situation was great. So it's, you know, people are trying hard to, you know, up there in Spring Street or wherever, they're trying hard to address it. But you if you don't look at the whole endemic issues within your system from top to bottom, you won't address it. A really good example, you know, is the, you know, we hear about rehabilitation all the time and we're rehabilitating prisoners you know, 96%, 95% of the time is spent with prison officers. And I chatted to one the other day. He said, I've got half the staff I had that I had 5 years ago to manage the same number of prisoners. Well, okay, what happens to rehabilitation of the prisoners when that happens? You know, so you can't just look at mental health. You can't just look at trauma. You've got to look at the context that occurs in, and structurally and organisationally, what are we asking people to do? Another example is that, you know, correction officers or police officers hardly ever mention shift work as a factor because they're just so used to it. You know, there's no debate. That's what you signed up for. That's what you're going to get. Reality is shift work is exhausting. Fatigues people, and then concurrently fatigued have to go to a critical situation and make spot on decisions. I mean, it's not looked at.
It's pretty difficult when you're sleep deprived, isn't it?
High risk occupation,
yeah.
Hypervigilance, which you know is not understood. And you know, one of the things that if you look at what if the worker bees will give you the answers to what you need to do. You know, if you actually understand what they're saying and digest it and not be defensive to it, they'll give you the answers about what they need. It's all there, you know.
Well, it sounds like it's very valuable for them to hear that, and hopefully in some cases it is happening, but it sounds slow.
Innately as a counsellor, if you see someone that's hurt, you want to do something to help them. You just do. And that's what we need organisations to do in a more thorough way of, okay, we really need to roll our sleeves like Michael did with his soiling kids. We really need to hear what they're saying and give it credit. That's my battle. Yeah.
I think giving it credit, believing it, working with it, that's fundamental steps.
You know, and I think I mentioned one of the other podcasts mentioned again, you know, that sometimes I'm learning if I go in and sit with the workforce and run focus groups and really gather what they say and I table that through the system, it won't go anywhere because it's just too hard. It's just too hard. You know, how do we run a jail and deal with all that? How do we run a police force and deal with all that? But that's where my view of narrative and why it's so important. And I often say, as one of my many one-liners, if someone tells you something verbatim, I think there's a fair chance it's been said. People don't make up verbatim comments. So when people recall incidences of trauma or visions that they still have from the trauma or things that people said to them at the time and post the event, they're probably true.
They just need the person to listen and accept it and work with that.
And work with it.
Yeah.
And listen to, you know, the overwhelming evidence that's around us about the importance to do it.
So it sounds like you've really taken the knowledge that you've gained from Michael White's training and moved it into an area that perhaps he wouldn't have had that opportunity because of his,
Look, I often think of Michael, but I don't think of Michael Daly, but I often think of him. And he was always, I bumped into him in Adelaide. I'd went over there some training 3 weeks before he died and I was walking to Adelaide and he was walking out of Adelaide. So it was just a random bumped into him. And his first question was, well, what are you doing now? You know, what's going on? And I think at some point I was at Alzheimer's in those days and I'd just done a video interview and I told him about that. And he said, oh, that sounds so interesting, you know. And I asked him what he was doing and he said, oh, I'm really starting to think about backing off on the international travel. And I should say Michael is known all over the world. And I'm thinking about focusing on, you know, my narrative ideas and doing less travel and more reading. And I really want to get into the domestic violence. And Michael had historically always been involved in that, and he wanted to go back to that and look at that a bit more narratively. And so it was a wonderful conversation, but it was never about him. It was always about, so Michael would have been very interested in all of this, I know, and would have understood what it was about, although there's a lot of me in it, you know, now as well. So,
but you're definitely using, you know, all what you've gained from him and be a testament to him, I'm sure, in many ways. And I, you know, just to say that I did know, had met you at that time, I think, known you for 6 months, and we worked together, and I do recall you being very affected. After Michael passed away, it was such a shock.
Because of, you know, I was one of the lucky ones, you know, to see him work directly, you know, to sit behind the screen and watch him, you know, therapeutically, his ideas around grief, trailblazing in everything he did. So, yeah, he was a brilliant man. And, I do miss him a lot. Yeah. All righty. Well, thank you very much. Quite different being on the Being Interviewed.
Well, you do have your Let's Talk Differently as your logo and your business, and so it has been different for you, which is good.
Yeah.
And I've really enjoyed listening to you. And
oh, thank you. So much to learn. My aim was to really set to encourage people to, you know, contact me if they want to share their story. And even though this is public, it's not counselling as such, but, you know, it's just so important to hear people's stories. So, and generally people will say to me, it's helpful. It was good to talk about what I went through or what I experienced. Or, and also for officers that love it, you know, you come in and tell me too, because I need to hear, you know, those stories as well. So,
no, that's great. People getting that opportunity, which is a little bit rare these days. Yeah. Well done.
Thank you, Felicity. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for joining me on this latest episode of Trauma from the Frontline. If you are enjoying this series, please make sure you follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you find this information valuable, we ask that you rate the show 5 stars. If you would like to get in touch with me, please feel free to email me at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au. Until the next episode, please take care. If this episode has raised any issues for you, free counselling is available through your organisation's employee assistance provider, Lifeline on 131 114, or Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636.